There are many native plants and grasses that can add a lot of interest to your landscape. Might be prairie smoke or wild ginger or columbine. A whole host of them, and they attract birds and bees and butterflies, and that makes for a healthier ecosystem. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on this edition of Garden Talk. And as wonderful as prairies are, they can also sometimes be weed magnets, or you can have some problems with weeds anyway as you're establishing those prairies. We'll talk about that and other things as well with Neil DeBull, who is the head guy at the head person at Prairie Nursery. He comes by a few times a year to talk about prairies and native plants and why you should appreciate them and why you should use them. And Neil, always great. Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having me on again.
Is this a busy time? I mean, if you're thinking about starting a prairie or you already have one going, maybe it's new, mm-hmm. busy time?
Well, it depends on what stage you're at. If you look at the prairie, there's basically three stages. One is the site preparation period, yep. where you're getting rid of the weeds before you put in your seeds or plants. The second phase is after you've installed your plants or seeds is making sure you've got weeds under control. And it's so important at the outset to make sure that you don't let problem weeds get established. And then once your prairie becomes established, occasionally you might have some incursions by some perennial weeds. By then, you've usually got the annual weeds under control, biennial weeds under control. But you may have some problems with some perennial weeds in after like the third or fourth year. And occasionally there are a few biennial weeds that can be long-term problems, like sweet clover, Queen Anne's lace, wild parsnip, these sorts of bad actors that are pretty tough to get rid of sometimes. So
yeah.
we've got to have strategies for managing that.
Because you mentioned weeds right away, Joy in West Bend is already with us with a question I think that relates to weeds. So let's go to Joy. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having this subject.
Sure.
Our family has a constructed wetland wastewater treatment system. That is, we have kind of a shallow bed in which we planted like wet prairie plants, and that our sewage water goes into that system to take up the nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that put in the year 2000, and since then we've done some weeding, not great weeding. Originally there was sedge grass and a lot of kind of, like I said, wetland prairie forbs planted in there. We've still got some of them, but we also have a lot of stinging nettle. We have a lot of ragweed, and, of course, we have some trees growing in there. So we recently had a man come out and check on it for us and tell us how to, you know, cut down the trees and just spray a little bit of pesticide right on the places that we cut. But I'm wondering, when we take out the weeds, like the stinging nettle and the ragweed, then we have some open area, and I don't still have the list of things that we planted in that, so
looking for a little advice there,
yeah,
I'll bet.
Yeah, I have planted I have planted spiderwort, but and that's doing well, but otherwise I just wonder what else we can plant in there.
Okay, let me ask you a few questions, Joy.
Sure.
First of all, is this area just damp, or do you actually have standing water in this system?
It's damp.
It's damp, and the water is treated below that, correct?
Right.
Okay.
There's pea gravel, and then there's about a layer of 4 inches of soil on top.
Okay, got it. Okay, just want to make sure I understood the hydrology of your system.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, when you are you going to cut out the trees? Do you have a schedule for that?
We just took care of that recently, and then, you know, we'll go back and do that again and again. We have black walnuts on our property, so
yeah, they like to move around. Okay, yeah. Well, you know, when you're treating trees, whether it's in a prairie, a wetland system, or whatever, usually the best time to do that is in the fall, because the energy of the plant is translocating down into the roots. It's taking its energy from the year's growth, and that is when you apply the herbicide directly onto that cut stump. It will go down into the root and kill the plant. In the spring, it's a little dicier because the energy of the plant is moving up, and so you don't get as good a kill. Now, it does depend upon the herbicide you use. In many cases, Glyphosate or Roundup is commonly used for this method, and you can use it in the fall very effectively, but it does not necessarily work in the spring or the summer as well. There are broadleaf herbicides which are generally considered to be more toxic than Roundup, although people will argue these things, but generally speaking, Roundup is considered a little bit more benign. But you can use these broadleaf herbicides and do this in the summer and get good results, just so you understand the timing and what herbicides you're using for controlling brush, like trees, shrubs, etc. But the stinging nettle is a rhizomatous plant. It creeps and crawls, and that's really hard to get rid of. You could make soup out of it. It makes an excellent soup, but make sure you wear gloves when you collect the stinging nettle to make your soup. And it's really quite nutritious, very high in vitamins. So there's a good thing that you can do with that stinging nettle, but you have to make sure you remove all the rhizomes, and it's very difficult to do that. But if you keep after it, you can use a dandelion digger and just dig up those rhizomes. Again, make sure you're wearing gloves and long-sleeve shirts, or you will feel that for many, many hours, as I have done myself. Then, as far as what to do for replacement plants, I will tell you our workhorse plant in our rain gardens. And your system is going to be pretty similar to a rain garden, although it doesn't dry out like a rain garden. But our workhorse plant that we use in our rain gardens is a plant called fox sedge. Fox like the animal. That's Carex vulpinoidea. And this plant is amazingly adaptable. It will grow in damp soils, not standing water. It'll tolerate standing water in the spring, but it grows in damp soils, and it will also tolerate drying out later in the season. So if you're looking for something that will help keep the weeds out too, the fox sedge has very thick, dense roots, and so it helps to occupy the soil surface and the rooting zone, so it reduces the opportunity for weeds to invade. It's not foolproof, but if you're looking for a plant that will really help to stabilize your system, that is a great choice.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Good luck.
Good luck, Joey. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. You know, you're talking about that that plant, and it reminded me that you have your June nursery tour and big plant sale is on Saturday, and lots going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, we have two tours during the year. One is the third week, third Saturday in June. The other one's in August. So that's coming up here Saturday, June 20th, and we have tours at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. And of course, we have our spring plant sale as well, where we've reduced prices on many of our plants. So people come on up and take a walk in our garden. I will caution people that we've had an extraordinarily busy spring, and we've been so busy, we haven't really done a very good job of getting our garden ready. So I'm going up there about 6 o'clock tomorrow morning to pull some weeds and try and get it presentable. But, you know, a lot of areas of prairie plants are pretty self-sufficient, so there's not a lot of weeds, but just some areas where there's a couple here and there. And so just be prepared. It's not going to be its normal, beautiful setting, but it'll be nice, and there's a lot of good plants available on sale.
Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jim in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for letting me ask a question.
Sure.
One of the things I'm curious about is I've established prairies before where we applied Roundup or glyphosate and then started from scratch like that. But I have an area now that is all Kentucky bluegrass, and it's about a half acre, so it's a pretty good-sized area. I don't think we're going to be able to apply Roundup to it. We're trying to establish it more organic. And I was wondering, how do you do that? Can you overseed into the bluegrass? Or is there anything you would recommend without having to try to kill it all off?
If you don't kill it off, Jim, you're going to have a real tough row to hoe. Now, there are, of course, many ways to kill it off. You don't necessarily have to use Roundup to kill it. However, on a large area like that, that makes your job a little more challenging. On small areas, you can smother it for a full growing season. Put down black plastic or old carpets or rugs or cardboard, a couple layers of cardboard, and put it on in April and keep it on there until September, and that bluegrass should be deader than dead by the fall. And then you can just scatter your seed into the dead sod in the fall. It doesn't hurt to put a layer of clean, weed-free straw about an inch deep over it when you put your seed down to provide a little a little cover for when it germinates in spring. It'll help hold the moisture in because the seed's going to be pretty close to the soil surface. On a half an acre, that's a lot of black plastic, cardboard,
yeah,
or whatever.
Okay. It's a half acre, and it's a very steep hill.
Oh, it's a steep hill. Boy, you got a tough one here. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. If this were mine, I would spray it with Roundup every two months. The sod will hold the hill in place, and then you can scatter your seed onto that sod, and it wouldn't hurt if you put down a nurse crop like oats at 128 pounds per acre. So you'd need 64 pounds of oats, which is two bushels, and you scatter that in there with your prairie seed, and that should germinate in the fall and help provide some cover. But that bluegrass, if it's a solid bluegrass sod, you can kill that off either with smothering or by spraying with Roundup, and it should hold your hill in place for one growing season. And your oats, that will help hold it. But if you don't want to use the Roundup, then that's going to be a little bit more of a challenge. But I can guarantee if you just go and scatter seed into that bluegrass, it's going to be tough because when you're dealing with vegetation, you have to think like an attorney. Possession is 9/10 of the law. Okay, and whoever's got it is going to keep it, especially bluegrass, which is a rhizomatous, very aggressive grass, which is why it's a great turf grass because it's a tough customer. But if you don't kill that off, you can spend a lot of money on seed and get very little results.
If this was on sort of a flat area and what really was Kentucky bluegrass, could you take it off and sod? Or
absolutely, that's another choice. Yes, you can take a sod cutter. I've done this very successfully. You take a sod cutter, bluegrass, a couple inches deep, and you've got the roots. And oftentimes, there are very few weed seeds underneath the surface soil. And you remove the bluegrass and most of the weed seeds, in, depending on the history of the site and how long the lawn has been there. But I've done this in areas where you had established bluegrass, had been there 20 years, took the bluegrass off with a sod cutter and just roughed up the soil a little bit and put the seed in there. And we did this in the spring, and we got phenomenal results with almost no weeds. So that's another way to do it. And another way is to repeatedly till it. But I will tell you, if you have ever tilled a lawn of bluegrass, you will probably not want to ever do this again. I did it a couple of times. You need an industrial tiller, and I was using one of these, and it got away from me, and it took off across the yard. It ran into a fence where it finally stopped. So, I mean, these things, and because it's bouncing off of that sod, it's
sure.
you gotta really, it's like a wild horse. So that's why, you know, a lot of people love Roundup. So anyway, I hope that gives you some options there for doing.
Thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
All right, good luck, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. And Dennis in Springfield, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. I have approximately 90 acres. For 23 years, it was CRP. The last 3 years, they followed the corn, the Roundup corn routine, and killed off all of the CRP. If it doesn't work out with the renter, I was thinking of going to prairie. Is the Roundup applications and spraying that they've done the correct preparation that you're referring to with the Roundup? And what are prairies? Are they these tall grasses you see out west, or what's a warm season short prairie? Or do we have tall prairies in Wisconsin? I don't know anything about these prairies.
Sure. Okay. Well, when you say is that using the Roundup Ready corn, is that the right way? It's a great way to get an area ready for planting a prairie. There are those people who are not in favor of genetically modified organisms who say that is absolutely the wrong way and nobody should do that. But the fact of the matter is that over, 90% of our corn and beans in America is now Roundup Ready with, you know, all sorts of other aspects of what that entails. But if you are converting a weedy old field or a CRP field or something where you have all kinds of vegetation in there, what we normally will do if we have a large area, we will run Roundup Ready corn for 2 years and then Roundup Ready beans for 1 year, which gives you a nice, smooth, level planting surface. You might have to do a little fine grading to get it ready to go after the beans. And sometimes beans come off fairly late in the year, so rather than being able to do a fall seeding, you'll probably might have to do a spring seeding, although depending on the weather, you may have an option. There are advantages and disadvantages to both, fall seeding versus spring seeding. We can get into that later. But this is an excellent way to cut your costs, because normally if you're preparing a prairie, a lot of people will go out and spray it with Roundup to kill the weeds off on a large area because you can't smother it. And tilling, I used to do everything organically. I used no Roundup, and I would till the field every 3 weeks. Well, you do an environmental impact statement on that. Okay, how much diesel fuel are you using for your tractor? And so on and so forth. You actually end up with a huge carbon footprint. So figure out what you're comfortable with. But if you run corn for 2 years and beans for the third year, then you usually will be done with all the problem weeds. But monitor that, because there are some weeds that are not killed by Roundup, such as field bindweed, mm-hmm. Canada thistle, crown vetch, which you normally would not find in a cornfield. But if these are not killed by the treatment of the Roundup, then you will have to use a broadleaf herbicide to kill them, or a combination tank mix of broadleaf herbicide with Roundup, which, of course, you cannot use during your bean crop. You may or may not be able to use it during your corn crop, so you will have to look at the strategy involved. So what is a prairie? Well, a prairie is a grassland, and a grassland typically has a strong component of grasses with many different flowers, or technically called forbs. And if you look at the structure of the North American prairie, which reached from Canada all the way into central Texas, you have the eastern tallgrass prairie, which ran from Ohio into Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and the Dakotas. And then you have the shortgrass prairie, which ran basically from the Rocky Mountains east into central Kansas, et cetera. And there was an area in between called the mixed grass prairie where these things met up. Now, in Wisconsin, we have primarily tallgrass prairies, but on dry, sandy soils, we will have what we call short prairies, and because of the very dry conditions. And you also can plant shorter prairies on heavier soils where tall prairies would normally dominate. And you can control pretty much to some degree the composition of that prairie and the species in it and the heights by matching the proper plants that will grow on those soil conditions on your property. But mm-hmm. when you start to get into heavy clay, you get into trouble with short prairies, because most of the plants that grow on heavy clay typically are the stronger, taller, more robust plants. So you try and establish a short prairie on heavy clay, you get into some difficulties, and you have to be very selective.
And you mentioned them as grasses, but and I wouldn't want to leave the impression that there are no flowers associated with prairies.
Oh, lots of flowers. And interestingly, the composition, though, the ratio of flowers to grasses has been historically subject to debate. there has been a period that, based upon studies in the mid-20th century, that all prairies are 80% grasses and 20% flowers, because those were the remnants that were found. But you read the early explorers' accounts of the prairies of Wisconsin, they were flower gardens covered with flowers. And the prairie remnants we have don't have that. And why is that? Because they weren't grazed. There were no bison or elk left. They weren't burned necessarily, yeah. which helps to regenerate many of the species, including the flowers. And so they weren't really working prairies. They were these derelict prairies that sat there, and the grasses tend to take over with no other influences such as grazing, burning, et cetera. So, when I first started doing this 33 years ago, I came up with this crazy idea of, not everybody wants 8-foot tall grasses in their front yard. So I created a short prairie mix. And this was just complete anathema to the purists who said, well, you can't do that. That's not a real prairie. Well, my customers don't want a real prairie. Okay, they want something shorter.
Yeah.
So that was kind of, I went against the gospel.
The grain.
The gospel of what a prairie was. But that's okay, and it's really helped to popularize this. And so people now can control more of the look that they have on their property. And you can also control the balance of flowers to grasses. So you can put as many flowers in there as you want. But you do need the grasses, because the grasses help to provide the fabric and the dense root systems that help to squeeze out the weeds. The perennial grasses are the workhorses that squeeze out the weeds. And they give you fall and winter color when all the flowers are done. So they're a very important part of that community. It's just a question of balance.
And so the critics were saying to you, Neil, come out of the wheat field. You're going against the grain.
That's right.
Oh, well, that's the worst I could do today. David in Minnesota. Well, wait a minute. Did we answer all of it? I think we did.
I think we did. There's a lot of territory to cover, like defining what is a prairie. That could take an hour and a half right there.
David in Minnesota, thank you very much for calling. Hello, what's on your mind? Did we lose David?
Hello, am I on in the air?
Yes, you're on.
Yes, my name is David Benson. I'm traveling through from southwestern Minnesota. I always enjoy Wisconsin Public Radio, and I just heard about the prairie special program. The issue of reed canary grass as an invasive, we have a lot of RIM, Reinvest in Minnesota, and CRP, and we get reed canary coming out of the wetlands. Any ideas, or should I follow my son's advice and just give up?
Well, reed canary grass is a real bear. And I met with a client yesterday up in Rudolph, Wisconsin, and looked at her prairie in a wetland area that's having problems with reed canary grass. And there are ways to deal with this. However, they're pretty specific. Studies have shown, and I have actually used this method, if you have an infestation of reed canary grass in a wetland area or a prairie, you can burn it right now in the middle of June, which sounds absolutely counterintuitive and idiotic. But if you have sufficient dead grass material, fuel, fine fuel to carry a fire, if you burn reed canary grass now, it's in full flower right now, you will knock it right on. You will knock it right on its hind end, and the native sedges and wildflowers that normally occur in a wetland, assuming there are some in there and the reed canary has invaded that area, will recover much more rapidly than the reed canary. If you can't burn it, you can mow it to the ground. Now, the issue here is that when you do this burning and mowing in mid-June, you're going to undoubtedly destroy some grassland nesting bird nests. So you do have some collateral damage that you have to be prepared for. And there are also some other, you know, small mammals, snakes, et cetera, that are probably going to be harmed as well. So there is a downside to this. Another option, if you're not going to do the mid-June burning or the mid-June mowing, and I mean mowing, you mow it right to the ground. Okay. The other choice is to use grass-selective herbicides. And there's an herbicide called cefoxitin, which is also known as Post or Select, or there's a bunch of different names that it's marketed under. But S-E-T-H-O-X-Y-D-I-M, and there's a very close relative of that called Clethodim, C-L-E-T-H-O-D-I-M, which you can use to spray reed canary grass. And it doesn't necessarily completely kill it, but it puts a world of hurt on it. However, it will also put a world of hurt on your warm season prairie grasses. So you have to be very careful with your timing. So if you're going to do this, warm season prairie grasses come up much later than the reed canary. The reed canary grass is a cool season grass, comes up early, and you can go out there in mid-spring, just before your prairie grasses come up, and spray that reed canary with it. It won't kill it, but it's going to really whack it. The other option here is to go into your prairie around early August and mow it to the ground. Mm. And then everything will come back, and the warm season grasses will go dormant earlier, but the reed canary grass will stay green. And you have to mow it back to the ground because you have to get fresh growth in order to use an herbicide treatment in the fall. So normally we would mow this around early August. The warm season grasses, once they've gone completely dormant, you can then go in and hit the reed canary with the cefoxitin or the clethodim, and that's going to really hammer it because a fall spraying goes straight down into the roots and does huge damage. But you have to make sure that the warm season grasses are completely dormant, and if you have any cool season grasses, they will be affected negatively as well. But the beautiful thing about these two herbicides is that if you have sedges in there or bulrushes, genus Carex, Scirpus, you will not damage them because they are not affected by them. So there's your trick for how to manage reed canary grass, and good luck. It's a real bear, but there are ways to deal with it.
All right. Good luck, David. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Kathleen and Delavan, we turn to you next. Hi, Kathleen.
I continue on my mission to grow native plants for pollinators. And just received a shipment from Neil for a lakeside planting at a luxury home of the ivory sedges, and the rest of their garden in front by the lake drive of Delavan is all native plants, and it's beautiful. Nobody else has it. So just trying to promote pollinators and letting people know that you don't have to have prairies to grow these beautiful plants. And the sedges is looking great.
Excellent. You know, and you bring up a really good point here I want to make, Kathleen, is that if you want to support pollinators, and remember that one-third of the food that we eat has to be pollinated.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people don't realize that. They think it comes out of the back of this grocery store. But one-third of the nuts, berries, etc. Are pollinated. So it's so important that we have good, healthy populations of pollinators. And
And plus they're beautiful. You have to be a little more selective. You can't, you don't want these six-foot-tall things. But, and I've learned not to over-amend the soil. But just even breaking up the clay, you know, it's amazing what the information says that it won't grow in this or this. But when you're growing it in a typical garden, it's amazing. Some of these plants love it are just go crazy.
It's amazing. Yeah, and you know, another thing here is that, and I'm sure you follow this, is that we don't use insecticides in our fields because that kills our pollinators, pollinates the seeds. Pollinates the flowers to make seeds. And so if your goal is to have pollinators, throw away all your insecticides. Get rid of them. You don't need them. Get rid of them. And if I don't see holes in the leaves of my plants, I know that my plants, they're not functioning. They're not providing life. They're not providing food to my critters, my butterflies, and other insects and invertebrates. So people are all crazy about, oh, there's holes in the leaves, holes in the leaves. Well, that's a good thing. You should embrace that. Because when the monarch butterfly is eating the milkweed, there's going to be holes in the leaves.
There is for sure. Kathleen, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Neil DeBole, our guest, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Having some fun today talking about prairies today with our guest, Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery here in Westfield. And you don't need necessarily a huge tract of land. You can do it in your backyard. You can have prairies and wonderful prairie plants. And I certainly encourage you to look at them. I'm Larry Mueller again, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. I'd certainly love to hear from you. Richard and McFarland, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, I'm starting to get an invasion of crown vetch into my long-established prairie. I want to know how I can deal with it.
Crown vetch, that is one of the worst possible weeds you can get in a prairie. And this is a non-native plant that was brought here for stabilizing hillsides, and the people who brought that in should be excoriated and more. But the problem with crown vetch is that it creeps by rhizomes, so it crawls throughout your prairie, as I'm sure you know. It also spreads by seeds. And if you try and control it with Roundup or glyphosate, it basically bounces off of it. So you are forced to either dig it out, which is almost a fool's errand because it has numerous rhizomes that creep and crawl everywhere, and if it mixes into your sod of your prairie, it's very difficult to get it out without doing lots of damage to your prairie plants. And if you spray a broadleaf herbicide to kill it, which is the most effective method, is also going to kill your prairie flowers. So what do you do? Well, if you have an area that it's isolated in, or even a large area, you can go in the middle of summer, when it's blooming, which is usually the most effective time to apply an herbicide, if an herbicide is acceptable. Or you can pull it and pull it and pull it for about 3 years, and you might exhaust the roots, where you pull it every 3 to 4 weeks and just pull up the new sprouts, and you will eventually exhaust the rhizome. So these are the organic ways to do it, digging it out or pulling the leaves off of it, the stems off of it, for years. If you're going to go the herbicide route, you have to use a broadleaf herbicide, and you will... Only way you can do that without harming your flowers is to take a pruning shears and cut your flowers off so there's no leaves. And then put a little dirt over the cut stem to make sure there's no way herbicide can get onto that cut stem. And then you can safely spray a broadleaf herbicide. It won't bother your grasses, but it will kill the crown vetch. So that's a pretty radical method of doing it. But if you really want to get rid of it, you're either going to dig it out, constantly pull it, or have to spray it. But if you spray it, cut your flowers down. So there's absolutely no vegetation that can be come in contact with the herbicide, and then you can safely go in there and do that.
There you go.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, it's
really
a tough one.
It's just horrible.
Thanks, Richard, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Jim and Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
We have a problem with goldenrod in our prairie. The prairie's about 10 years old, and it was doing good. But goldenrod, Canadian goldenrod, is coming up in it. And I remember you talking about mowing twice a year to try and take the energy out of it when it's growing the flowers. And we did that for a couple years. It seemed to be working pretty good. But last year we did a burn early in spring. And what happened is we had a lot of switchgrass pop up all of a sudden. We had a few plants, but it got really thick last year. And by burning, it seemed like we kind of smothered out the goldenrod because we didn't have much of a problem. However, this year, it's come back about as bad as it was when we first started trying to get rid of it. I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Well, let me ask you a few questions, Jim. How much area are you dealing with? How large an area?
That particular prairie is about an acre and a half to 2 acres.
And how much of the area is affected by the Canada goldenrod?
I would have to guess maybe a quarter acre or so.
A quarter acre. Okay, good. So it's limited right now, relatively speaking.
Relatively speaking. Yes.
Okay. This is a really tough one, too. Canada goldenrod is actually the worst weed we get in our prairies. It's a native.
Oh.
It's a native plant. It should be on the horrible weed list. But because it's a native plant, it gets a pass, which is nonsense because it's a horrendous, horrific weed. And it's a perennial. It creeps by rhizomes. It flies in by on the air. I've got it in my prairie. I go out after a rain and I pull it. You take a dandelion digger. It has these big rhizomes, and I have an acre prairie, and it's here and there. Mm-hmm. And I go out. I mean, it used to be a lot more. I just turned around one day. Oh my God, where did this come from? It flew in. Yeah, it comes long distance on aerial seeds, and so I've been just. You can pull it, and you want to do it after a rain, so you can get as much of the rhizome as possible. And that way you can eventually remove it from the area by getting all the roots out. But this is a significant, significant effort. On a quarter acre, that's going to be a huge job. Another option is a method called the glove of death, where you put neoprene herbicide gloves that go up to like your elbows on, and then you put a absorbent cotton glove on one hand, and then you take a spray bottle with a concentrated solution of Roundup, 3% to 5%. You're not messing around here. You're going to nuke this stuff. And you saturate that glove so it's not dripping, and then you stroke the entire length of that of the stem. And this would be usually July or August when you have fully developed stems of the Canada goldenrod, and stroke it to apply the herbicide to the entire, well, at least two-thirds of the length of the stem, the upper half of it. But you must be extremely careful not to touch the desirable plants near it. I use my feet to kind of push them out of the way. But this is a really, I mean, this is a huge effort. Okay, another option is to, in the spring, when it's first coming up, if you have to learn how to tell what it looks like, and it'll get up about 3 inches tall. You take a backpack sprayer, and you're not going to be able to do this with Roundup. You're going to have to use a broadleaf herbicide. And you put I take a little funnel and turn it upside down. You cut the spout part of the funnel off so it just fits over the wand of your herbicide sprayer. Take off the nozzle, slip the herbicide, excuse me, the cut off funnel so it's upside down, so mm-hmm. it forms a cone of silence, okay? And then you put the nozzle
put it right
back
over
on.
Right
over the nozzle. Okay, so it's on the wand, and then you just duct tape it on there. And that gives you a way to control the spray, so it's only within that little cone, so it doesn't fly all over the place. And then when the Canada thistles are about 3 inches tall, excuse me, the Canada goldenrods are 3 inches tall, you go out there and just zip, zip, zip within the cone. And get them. And this, and it will take a couple of years, but you will get them. But it's
work.
It works. And, I mean, compared to going and digging them out of a quarter of an acre, this is way fast. I have a client who has 14-acre prairie. He had Canada goldenrod along the fence line. I said, you got to get rid of that. He says, well, I don't know, I'm not going to do that. His whole prairie turned into Canada goldenrod. Yeah. We had killed everything off. I said, you got to get rid of that. And it was west of the prairie, and it blew in onto the prairie, and he went out there, and he sprayed the whole 14 acres one plant at a time. So it took him years. Took him years.
Say, could I ask another quick question?
Okay.
I was wondering, you were just talking about getting rid of reed canary grass,
mm-hmm.
and you told the person that you could burn it right now.
Yes.
We have like three different prairie configurations, and two of them are long. They run along our long driveway. There is the goldenrod in there, too. But that one would be easy to burn. Even right now, it would be easy to burn because we have a driveway for a fire break and a plowed field on the other side.
Uh-huh.
Would that do anything to the goldenrod?
Probably not. No.
Okay.
The reason this is effective on the reed canary grass is that it's at its weakest point now. It's taking energy out of its root reserve to make those flowers. And so the roots are at a weakened point, and you're going to blast all of their vegetation off either by burning or mowing. And so they are at a relative disadvantage to other species. So, and it's particularly effective on reed canary.
Mm-hmm.
So goldenrod, if you were to do goldenrod, when it's in flower is its weakest point. But I've done this with one single mowing in late August when it's in flower, and it doesn't seem to phase it. So it's a terrible, terrible weed.
There we go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Thanks for calling. We have Lots of we have some Facebook questions and photos. Let's go to Melinda, who has an email, actually, a T-shaped tree line. Along the line, she has a weed patch she'd like to remove without chemicals. Can I put black plastic on all this area at once, or will it interfere with the water uptake of the tree roots?
That's a really good question, Larry. I've never tried this, so I honestly don't know. I would think it would interfere with the uptake of water from the tree roots by doing that. Having never done it, I can't speak to that. So, and here's another problem with black plastic. When you're using this in an area where you have deer populations, don't use black plastic, because the deer will walk all over it, punch holes in it with their hooves, and the weeds will get light through those holes and come right up through it. Unless you've got some super heavy-duty black plastic.
You know, if you put down, if you had cardboard.
Cardboard works great.
Because then the moisture wouldn't be an issue.
Oh, well, that's a good question. Would it? I don't know, you know.
Maybe it would?
It might. You know, once that cardboard gets kind of spongy, you might get some water through it. I don't know. I've never done this next to trees. I honestly don't know.
We have Eric in Madison next with a question. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about my family has some property up in the UP, basically about 30 miles north of Washington Island as the crow flies across the lake. And we've got about 20 acres of property, 15 of which is woods, and then the other five behind the house is an old farmland, like from the 20s. Was the last time it was probably tilled or farmed. And so I'm just wondering, you know, we had talked for numerous years about, well, maybe we should try to make this more of a natural prairie. But I'm just wondering if that's really too far north. I mean, it's more boreal forest up there, and so I don't really know if it's even worth trying to do something like that, because it's just maybe out of the sort of climate.
Eric, let me ask you a really important question. What's your soil type?
Well, the soil is about 8 inches, and then it's limestone right underneath that.
Okay, is it sandy? Is it clay? Is it loam? What is the actual soil above the limestone?
It's not clay. It's a little bit sandy, and I don't think it's loam at all. But it's, I know there's just a short or a small coverage over the actual limestone bedrock that's right underneath that.
Okay.
So
is that bedrock?
And it's also really damp up there too. I mean, it's really like the woods back there are they can get really
wet.
They can get really
Okay. Is that wet because it's in a low situation where you have a high water table, or is it because the water is held there by a non-fractured layer of limestone or dolomite?
I think it's held there by the non-fractured layer of limestone.
Okay.
I mean, we're up above about 30 feet above Lake Michigan. Like there's a cliff in front of our house up there.
Okay.
30 foot drop. So
yeah.
Okay. Well, if you had sandy soil, I'd say go for it, because interestingly, prairies historically extended from all the way up into northeastern Wisconsin, Marinette County, and across the UP on sandy soils. And interestingly, when you see forest fires, like in Marinette County, oftentimes what comes back in those areas are prairies that were just hanging on under the pine trees. So in that case, it's like, wow, you go forest fire. This is great. We got a prairie out of the deal. So there's this never-ending balance between jack pine and prairies. And you see prairies all the way up in Bayfield County in the Mukwa Barrens. There are some beautiful prairies. So, yes, you can establish prairies above 45 degrees north latitude. But you need a dry, sandy soil, because dry, sandy soils do not hold a lot of moisture, so they warm up rapidly in spring. Most of the plants that are in our native prairies are warm season plants. They don't like cold, wet soils, so they do not compete well in a northern climate. But on dry, sandy soils, they warm up fast, and the prairie plants have great, great opportunities to grow there. And there were prairies all through the UP over into southern Canada. So, but because your situation, you have a moist soil, and you have a soil that is probably going to stay cold in the spring, it's probably not a good candidate for planting a prairie.
There we go. Thanks, Eric, for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBoll, our guest from Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. We can have take your questions via Facebook. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Chris in Appleton has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a new house being built on the other side of my property, in the back of my property, and Neil, you had mentioned some people don't like the 8-foot grasses, but I would like to plant 8-foot grasses for some privacy. What grasses could I plant?
You're in Appleton, so you probably have clay soil. Is that right, Chris?
Oh, you bet.
Yeah, yeah, that beautiful Appleton clay, which actually is good because your tall prairie grasses really do well on heavy clay soils. You have three tall prairie grasses that you can easily establish on heavy clay soils that are well drained, not wet. And those would be big blue stem.
Big blue stem, okay.
Indian grass.
Indian.
Okay, like Native American grass.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Okay. And switchgrass.
Okay.
And switchgrass will get 5 to 6 feet tall. Indian grass will get 6 to 7. And big blue stem will get 6 to 8. And it was big blue stem that in the rich, super rich, wet Illinois prairies could get 10 feet tall.
Wow.
Yeah, and settler, the early explorers had to stand on the backs of their horses to see over it. It was so tall. But now, you're not going to get that on in Appleton clay because there's not.
Okay, so the switchgrass, how tall is the switchgrass?
5 to 6 feet.
Oh, 5 to 6. And
yes.
The big blue stem is the tallest.
That's the big guy. Okay, now, realize that these grasses do not reach this height until they send up their seed stocks in August. So you're not going to get year-round screening from them. And the big blue stem tends to fall down very rapidly in the fall. So it won't stand up in the winter. Indian grass will stand up fairly well, but the switchgrass has the highest standability of all the prairie grasses. So that will stand up over the winter. But generally speaking, your maintenance on your prairie grasses is either to burn them off in the spring every year, every other year, or to mow them down, again, in Appleton around mid-April. And let them regenerate. So you're going to lose that screen. Even if you plant the switchgrass for a screen, it'll stand up all winter unless you get a huge ice storm or just amazing amounts of snow. But when you mow it down in spring, you're going to lose that screen, and it will not return until it sends up its seed stalks in August.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So if you're looking for if you want a permanent screen, you want evergreens.
Yep.
Okay, not prairie. That's your permanent screen, and there are some low-growing, as long as you don't have deer, there are some nice arborvitae. Northern white cedar that make excellent screens. There's a great one called Technito. A friend of mine has developed this. Michael Yanni.
Oh.
And this plant called Technito, and it stays squat and short, and it's a fantastic, fantastic selection if you're looking for a northern white cedar or arborvitae for a screen.
So
but remember, deer will completely demolish it, so if you have deer, forget about it.
And when you say small, do you mean 6 feet or?
About 10 feet.
10 feet.
10, maybe 12. Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't get very big. It's slow growing, but it fills out. It gets nice and kind of chubby, and it doesn't get overly tall. So for an urban situation, it's a fantastic screen.
Perfect.
It loves clay. It likes a moisture, richer soil. But if you've got deer, they will eat it to the ground.
There you go, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Jim in Montreal. It's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
Okay, I have a small prairie about 1,100 square feet.
Okay.
And next to it, about 10 feet off, is a nice little patch of wild daisies, probably about 10 feet square, and they're really solid, and they really draw the pollinators, though, tons of bees. Well, some of the daisies are starting to creep into the prairie, and I just got rid of the last of the wild parsnips, and I was thinking of pulling up the daisies, and I thought, well, I'm going to save them. Should I be pulling them out?
It depends what you want, Jim. You want daisies?
The reason I'm asking, because this little patch that's growing outside of the prairie is, like, really solid.
Yes, absolutely.
It's choking out everything.
Yes, and that's because it's a white daisy, and it's about a foot tall, right?
Oh, these are almost 2.5 feet.
Whoa, you got some. You're in Montreal, Wisconsin?
Right.
Wow, you have some of that nice nice wet soil there growing these things, or in the dry ground?
It's
pretty dry.
Pretty moist.
Yeah, but you have a lot of rain this year up there?
Yes, we have, and it's been cool.
Yeah, that's why they're so big. That is a plant, chrysanthemum. And they are known for being allelopathic, meaning that the plant exudes toxins through its roots that will discourage the growth of other plants. It's basically using chemical warfare against other plants. And this plant is well known for this. And so if it creeps into your prairie, you may see that it will start to crowd out or actually discourage the growth of your other wildflowers in your prairie. So, and that's why you will see these large stands of it, not necessarily to the exclusion of everything else, but a lot of other plants cannot get past that boundary of chemical in the soil. So you would want to be careful with this. A few is okay, but if they get out of control, they may actually start to reduce the populations of your desirable plants in your prairie.
So get rid of them.
Well,
or at least get rid of some of them.
Either that or reach a detente. Okay. So, and you know, and this whole thing is about balance.
Yeah.
Okay. And because there's some weeds like reed canary grass, can you ever really get rid of it? It's very difficult. But if you can get it under control, and the whole purpose here is to foster a diversity of different flowers and grasses. So in a lot of cases, we just want to get it under control so that we have the diversity that will support the pollinators, that will support all sorts of life, and give us this wonderful series of blooms throughout the season and grasses in the fall and the winter.
And diversity reminds me that people are going to have a diversity of plants at your nursery tour on Saturday.
Yes. Nursery tour Saturday, June 20th, our spring nursery tour and spring plant sale. And we have tours at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. And also, you can check out more information on our website at www.prairienursery. That's P-R-A-I-R-I-E. prairienursery.com. And if you have we also have a catalog, so we'd be happy to send you a catalog. And you can call our office if you have questions about the tour or would like to order a catalog. You can call us at 1-800-476-9453, which is the same as 1-800-GROW-WILD, G-R-O-W-I-L-D. So 1-800-476-9453. We'd love to send you a catalog, or just check out our website at www.prairienursery.com.
We have a Facebook question from Josh wondering if you have any suggestions for dealing with locust.
With locust trees or locust bugs?
I think locust trees.
Locust trees, yeah, because it's a single. Well, yes, wonderful black locust, Robinia pseudo-acacia, which is a most aromatic plant, just finished blooming a few weeks ago, but it creeps by rhizomes. It is a native tree that was brought from the Midwest, southern Midwest, up into Wisconsin. It was used primarily for stabilizing eroding lands, particularly sandy soils, during the drought of the 30s. And it takes off like crazy, creeps by rhizomes, and invades everything nearby it. And I have black locusts on my property, which I inherited when I bought it. And I'm not cutting them down because I don't want them to smash the good trees that I planted around them. But the only way to get rid of black locust is to remove the entire clone. And they are clonal because you plant one tree and it sends out runners, these rhizomes. Yeah. And I grew up with this tree in my backyard. And I'd mow the grass and these sprouts would come up 2-3 feet tall in a matter of weeks from the roots because it wants to spread everywhere and create a big clone. So the only way to completely get it under control is to cut down the black locust trees in the fall and then apply herbicides such as Roundup or Garlon, an herbicide, and it's concentrated. You want to make sure that you use, generally speaking, you have to read the directions, but I use a 20 to 40% concentration of glyphosate, and you use it only on the cambium. The living part of the tree is just inside the bark. Mm-hmm. The first half inch inside the bark where the xylem and phloem are, that's the transport system for food and water. That's the only area you need to apply the herbicide. And I put it in a little dishwashing bottle with a top that goes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Not the kind of opens up on a cap, but it actually goes up and down. So you can control the flow, and I can get it to where it just drip, drip, drip. And so I can just put a drip, 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 drip right around in that cambium. So I use a minimal amount of herbicide. And if I knock the thing over, it doesn't make a big spill. Some people go out there with an open can and a paintbrush, and you knock it over, and you've got a huge herbicide spill on your property. Not a good idea.
No.
By putting it in that bottle, and a little plastic bottle with a little up and down a dispenser or a controller, you can just drip it on there. Use a minimal amount, and I'll tell you what, it'll kill it. But if you leave a few trees, they will continue to send out runners, and you'll be right back fighting the black locusts.
So you got to get rid of all of them.
Got to get rid of the whole batch of them.
Yeah,
it's a royal pain if you have a big patch of it.
What about getting rid of dog bane?
Well, that's interesting. Dog bane, there's two species. There's Indian tobacco and dog bane, opossum. Okay. And do you know that all of the milkweeds now have been moved into the Opossinaceae?
No.
They're no longer Asclepiadaceae. The brilliant people who name plants have decided they're no longer Asclepiadaceae. They need to be Opossinaceae. Okay, so now they're in the dogbane family, no longer in the milkweed family. Just like all the asters have been deported to Symphyotrichum, Eurybia, Oligoneuron, and these idiotic names that nobody knows or nobody cares about. So they're crazy. But dogbane is a highly invasive plant that creeps by rhizomes. And can really, they create big clones too.
Okay.
And a lot of people view it as a weed, but the dog banes are the number one plant as far as nectar source for butterflies. No species or no genus attracts more butterflies as a pollen source or as a nectar source than the dog bane and Indian tobacco. They're just ahead of the milkweeds. So if you want butterflies, the dog bane is a great thing. But it likes to take over, and on its report card, it says, does not play well with others. So it's a tough one. You have to make the call on that.
So, that is a hard one. That's a hard one to think about. Neil DeBow, our guest today, I want to remind you again, his website is prairienursery.com. It's prairienursery.com. And you can also phone at 800-476-9453 and get a hold of him. Neil DeBow, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. We're focusing on prairies with Neil DeBow, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. It might be a prairie that covers a half acre or 100 acres are more likely, or pretty much oftentimes, maybe it's just a space that's 10 by 20 or 10 by 10. You never know. Questions for him, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Judy in Madison, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question that I guess could relate to prairies, but also to regular yards. I have the misfortune of having silver maple trees on either side of me, and I was hoping that you might have some idea of anything that can be put down so the seeds won't become little trees.
I'll tell you what, Judy. I'll give you the advice that my boss, when I managed the Arboretum at UW Green Bay 35, 40 years ago, gave me. He said, Neil, you can solve a lot of landscape problems with a chainsaw.
that would be fine if it was on my property and not someone else's.
Yes. Yeah. And silver maples are
the worst.
Known for their fecundity and their very large seed set. When you say putting down, are you talking about like some kind of a herbicide? Is that what you're saying?
Right, yeah.
Well, you could. I've actually never thought of this or done this, but you could put down a pre-emergent herbicide just prior to the release of the seeds from the silver maple, and this would be in gardens or lawns where you have established perennial plants, not where you've seeded anything freshly, because a pre-emergent prevents the germination of seeds. Now, I mean, this seems like a pretty extreme step, but theoretically it should work. So you could apply a pre-emergent, and there are organic pre-emergents such as corn gluten. There are also chemical pre-emergents. One that's commonly used is called Preen. There are other formulations. But
and that should not hurt the plants that are already established?
It will not hurt lawns. It will not hurt perennials that are established. It will not hurt trees or shrubs. But you cannot use, you have to be very careful, Preen. Well, there's one type that's for ornamentals, and there's another for food gardens. You want to be careful. Do not put an ornamental herbicide in a food garden because it is not labeled for that use. So you have to be very, very careful And I would not use it in a food garden anyway. I don't use any. Right. I don't use any. I use no herbicides in my food garden. That's, to me, that's just like, no, that's verboten. So, but yeah, you could put down a pre-emergent, and you want, and the way it works is it's a mitotic poison. It prevents the division of cells at the root tip, so the seed will germinate and it cannot grow a root, and it eventually expires. And you would want to put this down just before the trees drop their seeds. And the pre-emergents are the same as the crabgrass preventer. You put it down just before the warm weather, and it prevents crabgrass from germinating in your lawn, so it serves the exact same function.
Yeah, well, those. I mean, if you once started, if you saw them starting to fall, if you just started right then,
I would do it a little bit before.
You want to do it before.
Because you want to get it into the soil and get it activated.
Okay.
Always want to do it before. Get it activated. So
get it going.
Yep. Because when those seeds come down, man, you want it pre-positioned. So as soon as they germinate, boom, they're getting nailed.
I've got one right next door to my house too. And I just
You know, we moved into our house. What, 28 years ago, and there's a silver maple there. And I said, man, you know, I'm going to cut that thing down. But, you know, it's a beautiful tree. It's nicely branched. I pick up about 10 branches a year that fall out of the stupid thing. But, the birds like it. It's there.
Yeah.
It's not caused me any problem, except that I get to, you know, haul wood out of there all the time. And on the west side of our house, someone planted a green ash, which is, to me, is just like another weed. And it was right over this deck. It was like 5-inch diameter. Now it's 21 inches diameter. It shades the whole west side of the house, and I am treating it for emerald ash borer. It cost me $250 to treat that thing this spring. But if I lose it, the whole west side of the house is going to be in full sun. Our deck will be in full sun like it was 28 years ago. It's just like, I can't believe I'm spending money to save a green ash. I have completely and utterly lost it.
Oh, my goodness. Stephen Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm on my third spring of working with a no-mow lawn at a place we built up in Mercer 3 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the topsoil that was brought in really wasn't very good. It turned out that the excavator scraped his mother-in-law's pasture and brought it in, and it just wasn't good soil. And last year when we got up there, there was an abundance of clover. Mm-hmm. And I actually raked a lot of it out and pulled it out. And when we were up there 3 weeks ago, the clover was overwhelming the no-mow lawn. And I talked to Sari at Prairie Home Nursery, and she said I probably would need to break down and use an herbicide, something chemical to kill it. And I bought Turf Builder weed and feed, and followed the directions. I calibrated a drop spreader and put it down, and I have a camera out the front window so I can see what the lawn looks like. And by looking at it at this point, it looks like the clover is still thriving. And she cautioned me not to use too much weed and feed on it because it would kill the no-mow as well. So I'm wondering, I'll be up there again Sunday night, and I'll be there for 2 weeks. I'm wondering, if the clover is still abundant, what's my next option? Could I just put more of it?
Well, let me ask you a couple questions, Steve. Is it red clover or white clover?
It's a low-growing clover, which sends out runners horizontally.
That's white clover. Okay.
Okay.
Interestingly, years ago, when I was a boy, when they sold turf grass mixes, they would often sell your turf grass with 5% Dutch white clover, which is exactly what you've got. Because this is before the vertically integrated companies started selling you fertilizers, herbicides, grass seed, and everything. So you would put the clover in there because it's a legume, and it would add nitrogen to your soil and feed your grass naturally. So you wouldn't have to put fertilizers on. Well, that's all over now that we have people brainwashing us to make our lawns look like golf courses and mow them within an inch of their lives and put all kinds of chemicals on them. But yes, clover can be a real competitor. And the reason that Sari told you not to put too much weed and feed on is because it has nitrogen in it, and the best way to really wreck a fine fescue no-mow lawn such as our product is to overfeed it with nitrogen, and all you're going to do is then encourage all sorts of other issues. But the nitrogen here, the purpose of that is to level the playing field so the grass is able to overcome the advantage of the clover, which has the ability to take nitrogen out of the air as a legume. However, if you're going to use an herbicide in this case, if that did not work, then you are probably going to have to apply an herbicide in a aqueous solution, in a water solution, and spray it on that. Because the nitrogen, you know, that may or may not work. But the problem with the white clover is mowing doesn't work because it stays so low, and mowing actually favors it because you'll remove everything above it. In my house, my no-mow lawn, I basically have areas I never mow, and you do have a few issues with trees trying to get in there and such, but in the areas where I do not mow, the grass is so thick, I don't have dandelions, I don't have creeping Charlie, I don't have any white clover, because the grass completely and utterly smothers it. Now, I don't know if that will work for you. Are you mowing this at all, or are you leaving it go?
Well, it's still real thin and not doing real well, and there's probably 40 to 50% clover this spring.
Okay. What kind of soil do you have there, Steve?
I don't know what it is. The excavator brought it in. We tore the old cabin down 3 years ago and built a retirement cottage there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes some of it looks kind of sandy to me. Some of it feels a little bit like it's got some clay in it. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a big factor because the no-mow grass does best on a sandy loam and a loamy sand. Or loamy soil. It doesn't do well on clay, and we make sure to let people know, don't put this on clay. And the white clover loves clay. And so it might be that and I don't know without seeing your soil, if it's got a high clay content to it, you may have a situation where it's just going to naturally favor the clover, which likes a rich, cooler, moister soil. The no-mow does better on a drier, sandier soil. So that might be kind of an ongoing issue. And the no-mow has difficulty really doing well on clay. So you might want to really take a look at that soil and make sure that you don't have some issues with that. But as far as the clover, to get rid of it, I would go in there at this point. You can't pull it out because it has this mat of roots. You would go crazy trying to pull it out. You could apply a broadleaf herbicide specifically designed for killing white clover, and then in the fall, in the month of November, overseed your no-mow. In the month of September, that's the best time to plant cool season lawn grass, whether it's our no-mow or bluegrass or whatever. That would be the time of year to overseed it after you have killed the clover.
Get that first.
Get the clover first because you got to get it out of the way and to open up the soil, and then come in September and overseed with the no-mow.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Glenn in Fox Lake, your turn. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
A couple of questions. I have, I hunt up in Marinette County, and my friend wants to eliminate planting corn, soybeans and things. He was thinking of maybe like just planting switchgrass, about 50 acres. Is that possible in Marinette County? It's fairly wet in the areas.
When you say fairly wet, Glenn, is it underwater in the spring? Or?
Yeah, well, it's really muddy.
Okay. What part of Marinette? I'm sorry?
In the southern part.
Southern part. Okay.
Right on the border of O'Connell
County?
O'Connell.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. Okay. You can definitely plant switchgrass there as long as it's not overly wet. Switchgrass is quite tolerant of moist soils. And you're far enough south, you should have good results with that.
Okay.
And it's been farmed, so you basically, I'm assuming there are very few weeds in these fields. Is that correct?
Right, yeah, they usually, yeah.
Yeah. Has he got corn or beans in there this year?
Yeah, there was last year, yeah.
Okay. Has he planted it yet this year?
No, they haven't done anything with it. Is it too late? Or?
Nope, you got until the end of June.
Okay.
I've actually planted switchgrass. Yeah, the clock is ticking. Okay.
Yeah, the clock. I have another question. Okay.
Let me finish your switchgrass question, okay?
Yeah.
Switchgrass is commonly planted, was commonly planted in monocultures by the DNR and wildlife managers to create dense nesting cover for ducks, etc. And for years I told them, you guys, you're planting a house without a kitchen because there's no food in there. And the dense nesting cover is great. And actually found that it was very hard for ducks to get their ducklings out of the dense switchgrass if it wasn't burned every few years. So it really did not function very well. Now for deer, pheasant, turkey, it's great. But actually, studies have shown that turkey actually prefer big blue stem and Indian grass to switchgrass and adjacent to oak woodlands. So, you know, it was thought to be this great thing 20, 30 years ago, but it really hasn't worked out that well. So, yes, you can establish switchgrass, and it's very competitive, and it'll keep a lot of bad guys out of there, but you will still have to mow it or burn it every few years to keep tree invasion out and possibly other weeds. I would encourage you, if your goal is to create a diverse habitat for wildlife, is to rather than plant switchgrass, plant a mix of prairie flowers and grasses on that area, which will be more expensive. Switchgrass is your absolute cheapest option because you can get away with 5 pounds per acre, a very low seeding rate. In a typical prairie mix, we usually use 10 pounds of flowers and grasses combined. So it is a very cost-effective way to get some cover in there, but the question is, what benefits will you actually get? You'll get cover, but not much more.
Yeah.
You had another question there?
Yes. I had a piece of property. I sold it to a friend of mine. I had like 10 acres of really nice varied prairie with different flowers in it.
Yeah.
And his find out that his granddaughter had a lot of allergies, so he's been mowing that every spring. Is he going to lose that base over time?
Okay, he's mowing it down every spring. What time in the spring is he mowing it?
Well, once it starts growing up a little bit, when it gets about a foot, he's been mowing it.
No, that won't affect it at all. It'll be fine. It'll change the balance of the flowering. He's going to probably tend to favor the warm season grasses because they're not growing very much in the first, you know, when it's foot tall. So a lot of the early spring flowers will be knocked back, but it will probably favor the warm season grasses and some of the later blooming flowers that will be less affected by a spring mowing. And the question is, are his daughter's allergies coming from the prairie or are they coming from another source? Because if you look at it, prairies are usually not associated with significant allergies. Your number one cause of allergies, of course, is ragweed, which is a native plant, but it's not a prairie plant. Your number two source is oak trees, and your number three source is bluegrass. So if you have a bluegrass lawn and you don't mow it, you're going to have number three allergy source. Fortunately, fine fescues in our NOMO mix is not in that top three. Another reason to plant NOMO instead of bluegrass lawn. So I would before I point fingers at the prairie, you probably want to do a more thorough analysis, and unless he's already figured out that her allergies are caused by some certain species in there, and that may be a possibility.
Yeah. So there you go. Thank you very much, Glenn, for calling in. Here's an appropriate question for you. Jacob wonders, where can you purchase seedlings to start a prairie, and what is a good resource for when I have questions about my prairie in the future?
Well, I don't know of any good sources to buy prairie plants. There's some place in Westfield. They've only been in business for 43 years now, so I really don't know if they'd be reliable. But you could Google it, you know, this prairie nursery place. But obviously we have a wide variety of not just prairie plants, but many years ago, customers would say, well, I don't have a lot of sun. I have shade. So we branched out into many woodland plants. So we have a wide variety of woodland wildflowers, sedges and grasses for woodlands, as well as ferns. And we've actually branched out into a lot more shrubs, too, a lot of wildlife shrubs, which were a big hit this year. We had huge success with shrubs for creating wildlife habitat, bird nesting areas, and food sources. So we have seeds. We have plants. And I do consultation and design. So if people need assistance with the actual design, they can give me a call at the nursery, and we can set up an appointment.
And you've got this weekend, you've got tomorrow, as a matter of fact, you've got the tour, the nursery tour, and your plant sale.
Yep. Saturday the 20th, we're having the tours at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., and our plants are on sale. Everything must go. Not everything. We've got to keep some more for the summer, but they're attractively priced for our spring sale. And then I do answer people's questions also at the tour. So if you have questions about your landscape, I'm available there to answer your questions, and I'll stay as long as it takes.
Bob in Wauwatosa has a question.
Hi there.
Yeah, hi, Bob.
Got a question about white clover. We have a healthy grass in our front and backyards, but we like to overseed it with white clover because we like the looks, and the bees seem to like it. Can you give me some guidance as to how to overseed with white clover?
Sure. It's funny, a caller just a little while ago wanted to get rid of white clover. And I remember when I was a kid, we had white clover in our lawn.
Oh, yeah.
I stepped on lots of bees in my bare feet, quite unintentionally.
I've got some white clover in my lawn right now, as a matter of fact.
it's pretty adept. You can just Google Dutch white clover. Okay, mm-hmm. And that's Trifolium repens. If you want to make sure you've got the right name, Trifolium, Trifolium, and the second name is repens, Repens, meaning it's reclining. It stays low to the ground. So just Google Dutch white clover, and you don't need a lot. A little bit goes a long ways because it creeps by rhizomes. And the best time to plant it, I don't know if there's any ever a bad time to plant that stuff. You could put it in September. If it doesn't come up in September, it'll come up next spring.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Bob. Thank you. Todd in Minocqua, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for your program. I really enjoy your programming and this program in particular. I don't know. I have a question that might apply. I don't know if it's a misnomer, but I have a wetland prairie type of area, and it can be flooded. My understanding is that you can flood cattails, and that will reduce the cattails.
Yes.
Is there a schedule that I should be following as far as when it could be flooded and when the water can be taken off to promote other vegetation to attract ducks?
Well, first of all, is it only cattails, or do you have other desirable vegetation mixed in with the cattails?
Unfortunately, it's all choked out with cattail.
Okay, well, that's good, because we won't be killing your good stuff.
Yes.
Okay, and I will tell you, I am not an expert at controlling cattails, but I know people who do this, and there's a danger that I might be a little bit off here, but the trick to controlling cattails, as I understand it, is to flood them. This is where I get a little fuzzy here. I think they're usually flooded over the winter and into the spring. And the cattails have to breathe through their, to get oxygen through their leaves. And you need at least 3 feet of water. Cattails will grow in 2 feet of water, but you get beyond 2 feet, you raise the water level up so it's 3 feet above the water, the ground level or the base of the, and that will typically kill them. The exact amount of time and the timing required to do that, I don't want to say something incorrect here. You need to do a little work, research. There are people in the DNR that have questions that can answer this question, but it is basically generally a 3 foot flooding. The question is exactly how long and what time of year to do it.
Yeah, that's tough to get. So I think, I guess there's a herbicide that you can have sprayed with permitting, but...
Yes, you can spray Rodeo.
Rodeo. I wanted to avoid that if possible, but I don't think I'm going to get 2 or 3 feet of water. I can get water, but...
And that's the problem is cattails are particularly adept at growing in mudflats, and when the water level is low, that's when they get established, and then the water comes up, and as long as it's less than 2 feet, they will creep and crawl and take over like crazy.
I really appreciate that piece of information.
Okay, well, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dolores wondered if you knew anything about seed bombing. If so, is it appropriate to do so on the roadside where there are lots of native plants?
Seed bombing. You know, I've never done seed bombing. And where you mix clay, wet moist clay with seed, and then drive around and throw it out the window. It's kind of like eco-terrorism, I guess.
Yeah.
I've never done that. It seems to me, there are people who have, and we have customers who buy seed to do seed bombing. But it's usually for like schools, and the kids get to have fun with it. And the actual effectiveness of seed bombing, I have no idea. It would seem to me that it's kind of going to be random. Also, remember, if you're just throwing it along roadsides, if there's established vegetation, it's going to be very difficult for those seeds to become established in a perennial vegetation over a sod that's already there. So if you're going to do it, make sure you find open areas and make sure that the seed species that you select for your seed bombs are compatible with the soil type, whether it's dry sand or heavy clay or nice loam. Make sure you pick the right species for your bombing.
And you know, Judith, Cyrus Poisson, made up some seed bombs.
Really?
A year ago. And in the spring, and so she gave me a few, and I tried it, and I don't think I got any of them to grow. I tried them, and there were a few areas along where I where I walk and jog, and they were, sort of public areas, and I tried it, and I kept watching, but nothing came up.
Yeah, it seems a bit random, and the other thing is that the seeds are all, when it rains, and of course the seed bomb melts, quote unquote. But you want to make sure it's on an open area where the seed can actually have an opportunity to get established and not trying to fight against established sod.
Neil, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Larry. Love being on Garden Talk.
Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin. The June nursery tour at Prairie Nursery is tomorrow. So you might want to take a look and see what he's got up there. Big plant sale as well. Let's see, Friday, next Friday, Christy Marsden joins us to talk about your garden. She's a horticulture educator with Extension. Physical therapist Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody join us on Monday. Stay with us.